Hello and welcome to EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. My name is Kirsten Müller-Fahl. I'm a medical doctor. I'm a neurologist and psychiatrist, and I'm working at Hannover Medical School. I'm the past president of the European Society for the Study of Tourette Syndrome, and my main focus is obviously in tic disorders and Tourette Syndrome. Today I have two guests. Welcome to Natalia Czajko and Anna Dulanska. Natalia Czajko is a neurologist. She is a board member of the European Society for the Study of Tourette Syndrome and the child neurology panel member of the EAN. She is specialized in movement disorders and also in tic disorders. And our second guest today is Anna Dulanska. She is a psychiatry resident and doctoral researcher at the Medical University of Warsaw. And she is mainly interested in functional neurological disorders and the border between neurology and psychiatry. And therefore, welcome to both of you. You are perfect for our topic today because we want to talk about functional neurological disorders and specifically about the link between functional neurological disorders and social media. So my first question goes to Dr. Natalia Czajko, and perhaps you can introduce the topic and describe what are the most common clinical presentations of functional neurological disorders we see today and perhaps we have seen in the past.
Yes, sure. Thank you so much for this kind introduction. Yes, of course. I mean, now we are learning more and more about FND, so functional neurological disorders. In our previous podcasts, we already mentioned that basically the definition of FND is, related to any kind of neurological symptom. That is really, we don't find any structural change in the brain. Or the basically the results of the neurological exam and the clinical course are inconsistent and incongruent. And what is also important that over time, the definition of FND also changed because now we use this rule in definition. So in order to diagnose FND, you should, during neurological exam, find some abnormalities that are typical for FND. For example, inconsistency in neurological exam of the tremor. And coming back to your original question, Kirsten, so basically any kind of symptomatology could be functional neurological disorder, any kind of neurological symptom, but the most frequent ones are so-called functional seizures. Before they were called non-epileptic seizures, but now there is also a shift in the name. And then the movement disorders, functional movement disorders, and I think the most common ones of them is functional tremor. But actually, our main topic of mine and Kirsten's interest are functional tic-like behaviors, especially in adolescents. They're also quite frequent. Like I said, any kind of neurological symptom could be functional. For example, now we have also a lot of patients with functional cognitive disorders, which are sometimes very tricky to differentiate for just cognitive decline. Yes, that would be, I think, my brief summary about the symptomatology.
Yes, thank you so much for this introduction. And today we want to talk about, not in general about functional neurological disorders, but we want to talk about social media and FND. Why is this of relevance and why should we talk about this?
Actually, I think that there are so many interesting aspects that we will discuss during our podcast. First of all, many patients, they seek information about FND and generally disorders in media and including the social media. I think that neurologists and doctors, we should be aware of this. And, you know, we have to be aware what are the risks and benefits of social media and the trends. The second important point, I think that Anya will talk about it, is, of course, you know, patients can use this as a support, supporting mechanism or to connect with each other. So not everything with social media is bad on FND, but we will, and I think this is an important aspect. Me and Kirsten, we observed, especially during the COVID-19 pandemic and many other researchers in the world, that in different different places in the world, there were people presenting with similar functional neurological disorders. So for us, one important example was functional tic-like behaviors. And then we realized that these symptoms were similar because people were sometimes observing, you know, some influencers that had similar symptomatology. So, of course, you know, we don't want to stigmatize anybody, but it's just an important social context for these disorders. I think it has to be taken into consideration because, as you remember, FND, it has a complex etiology. We have to always take into account, you know, this biopsychosocial model. So we know that people who have some biological predisposition for FND, with if it's combined with some psychological factors, but also social factors. And in this case, now in modern world, this social factor could be social media. Some people who have predisposition to FND can develop these symptoms. And I think that's why it's very important to discuss this. And it's our responsibility as doctors. And I think as the societies, such as European Society for the Study of Tourette Syndrome or European Academy of Neurology, to also fight against misconceptions related to some disorders and just inform correctly about it.
Mm. Thank you so much, Natalia. You already mentioned that there are positive aspects of social media when it comes to functional neurological disorders, but also negative aspects. Perhaps we should start with the positive aspects. And therefore, I would like to ask you, Anna Donalska, what are the positive aspects and how can social media platforms support our patients? And perhaps you can give us some concrete examples.
Yes, I'll start with the good news because there really is some. Media, including social media, can support people with functional neurological disorders, but only if the information is accurate. And part of our role as physicians, neurologists, psychiatrists is to guide our patients towards trustworthy sources. FND affects how the nervous system functions, not its structure, as Natalia said. And many patients arrive to our office frightened. They often take normal test results to mean nothing is wrong and I'm not being believed. Clear explanations help reduce the fear of emphasizing that symptoms are real, common, and treatable because it reduces stigma. It also helps in clinical practice. Many current resources highlight that FND is diagnosed using positive signs, not just by ruling things out. And when patients already understand that because of the social media resources, reliable ones, it's easier to build a shared model and move toward treatment. Another advantage of social media is improved access. Online platforms can provide psychoeducation and sometimes structured interventions. Here I can give example of FND Hope, a platform for patients with FND. And also I would like to encourage to familiarize yourselves with the site neurosymptoms.org, which is created by John Stone, and later it was translated into different languages, and it's a very valuable source of information for the patients. But education alone is not enough. It may improve understanding, but we should remember that usually it doesn't change outcomes on its own. I would think of good online resources as an on-ramp. They can help with engagement, but they need to lead into proper treatment. They can also reinforce what we explain in consultations, and this consistency builds trust and is very important. So to summarize, I would say that media can reduce stigma, improve understanding, and increase access, but it will only work if we guide our patients toward reliable sources and trustworthy content. Otherwise, the algorithm will do it for us.
Thank you so much. Unfortunately, we do not live in such an ideal world. And Natalia already outlined that there are also some risk and misinformation. And you also mentioned briefly what we have seen during the pandemic, this social contagion. Can you explain this a little bit more, what we have seen at that time?
Yes, yeah, so this is well, a big interest, especially of Kirsten, and I was supporting her a lot, and we did a lot of work together also within our European Society for the Study of Tourette Syndrome and many other researchers in the world. So so basically what we observed, especially this time, although probably this phenomenon is already known, was known before, is that in different clinics in the world, for example, in the UK, but also in Canada, in the United States, well, in these English-speaking countries, people, well, young people, especially teenagers, they developed functional tic-like behaviors, and they had similar symptomatology, which was very surprising, although the people were, you know, from totally different parts of the world. Like I said, for example, UK and Canada, and they never have seen each other. And these movements and vocalizations, they really resembled some of the ones that, and specific ones, for example, specific turn of phrases, which were very unusual to some influencers. And that's why, you know, in the earlier work, and Kirsten was the one who actually for the first time used this term. We could use here the name of the social contagion, you know, in this context. That's why we, in some of our papers, we use this terminology, mass sociogenic illness, because it's really here, this social media are sort of like a factor, unfortunately, that, you know, has this negative influence, like I said, on somebody. And that's why these people, they developed similar symptomatology. And it's interesting that it's really, you know, depending on the cultural context, too, because, for example, in Germany, in here, really, again, Kirsten's group especially worked very hard on this topic. There was another influencer who, well, I don't want to again stigmatize anybody, but who was a male, for example, and that's why, for example, in Germany, the symptomatology, phenomenology, and also this sex ratio was different than in English-speaking countries, because here, sort of the index case, as we call it, or the influencer was male. So you know, we're really learning about it. I think it's important for us to understand it, and like I said, to know how potent this is. So that's really, that it's a new and very strong factor that can have impact, like I said, on people who are predisposed to develop functional neurological disorders within this context, because you know, if I watch a lot of videos with people with tics, probably I will not. And I did watch a lot of videos of people with tics, and I never had tics. But for another person who has like a predisposition, like I said, this could be an important factor. So that's why we should take this into consideration and remember about it. And, you know, especially during the pandemic, probably this was present because people were, you know, with restricted contacts with others. They were at home. Young people, they felt really lonely, and they were using sometimes a lot or following the social media platforms. And we have hypothesized that this could be a mechanism. Again, in these people who really have the predisposition, probably even genetic or biological. But, you know, I think that we cannot ignore it anymore, because just social media is everywhere. And yeah, we have to remember about these risks. Yes.
Thank you. Thank you so much for these explanations. My next question goes again to Anna. What do you think, do all these different aspects influence our work with patients? So on one hand, do we see different symptoms? And on the other hand, what is your experience? Do patients have different expectations because of all this social media influence?
Yes, media, social media doesn't only help. It can also complicate the clinical work. And the first issue is these expectations, because patients often arrive in the office with ready-made narratives, which are shaped by what they've seen online. And sometimes it's helpful, but sometimes it's very misleading, but almost always it's very certain. And this can affect what patients accept as evidence and how these patients interpret diagnosis. And public conversations about FND are often highly polarized. Some argue it's overdiagnosed, while others see it as an overlooked neurological condition. And this can lead patients to experience this diagnosis as dismissive, even when it's not. The second issue I would like to bring up is symptom modeling. Since the pandemic, as you've already said, we've seen an increase in functional tic-like behaviors, especially in young people, and social media is often a part of this context. These cases differ from classic Tourette's later onset, rapid progression, and more complex symptom patterns. Most cases improve, but early recognition is important, because unfortunately, reinforcement can maintain symptoms. And a third issue is diagnosis itself. FND is not diagnosed by exclusion, it's based on positive clinical signs, as Natalia have already said. But patients exposed to scan equals truth may struggle with that. So we need to take a step back, we need to demonstrate the signs, so we need to show how symptoms change with distraction, and we need to explain clearly what it means to our patients. We need to show our work for them to understand it properly. And the fourth issue is iatrogenic harm. Communication plays a central role in FND. Harm may result from delays, misdiagnosis, or dismissal. And when patients already arrive skeptical, often shaped by online narratives, this becomes even more important. So what can we do? First, I would encourage to ask with curiosity. Ask what kind of information have you come across? what made sense to you. The second thing is to validate the experience, but separate it from explanation. You can tell your patients that your symptoms are real. Now let's build the most accurate understanding together. And it's also sometimes beneficial to explain the algorithm, to emphasize that social media promotes engagement, not accuracy. And the goal is not to eliminate the internet. It's to guide patients towards better information and help them find higher quality sources. And to plan follow-up, because one conversation rarely overrides months of online influence.
Thank you so much. Natalia already mentioned that we have this biopsychosocial psychosocial model for the occurrence and of FND. How does social media fit into this, Anna?
Yeah, let's look at social media within a broader context. FND is fundamentally a problem of brain function. These symptoms are real and involuntary. They result from how brain networks function, not from structural abnormalities. And in this biopsychosocial model, biology refers to brain network functioning. Psychology involves attention and expectations, and the social context now includes media environments. Predictive models are useful to understand this. The brain is continuously generating expectations. And in certain contexts, this expectation can influence perception and movement. That doesn't imply the symptoms are not real. It means they are generated by real brain processes. So where does social media fit in this model? We can see it as a trigger, because it can increase salience and provide symptom templates, especially in vulnerable individuals. It can also act as maintaining factors. It can reinforce symptoms via attention, comparison, and repetition. Unfortunately, it can also amplify stigma, which in turn impacts outcomes. But media can also help, as I've said previously, because structured online intervention and telerehabilitation have shown promising results in some cases. So media is not inherently negative, but it's a part of the environment. And I would say that media is not the cost of FND, but we should remember that it shapes attention, expectation, and belief, and it can either support or interfere with recovery.
Yes, thank you so much. Natalia, let's finally talk about ethical aspects and responsibilities on all sides. So on the side of the clinicians, but also on the side of influencers, journalists, and advocacy groups. So what do you think about this?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think so. That's yes, indeed, this is a nice, you know, summary point for all that we discussed. Because, as a matter of fact, you know, if I can mention here, but we plan to publish this, but I can just give an example. I think that we have a huge responsibility, especially as clinicians and representatives of, you know, opinion leaders in the field and European societies, and on the other hand, exactly the patients' organizations, on the shaping of the like Anna said, the narratives of disease. Because to give an example, you know, we and this is again Kirsten's work. Kirsten's team has shown how big are the misconceptions related to Rett syndrome in Germany, for example, in general public, that really, and we know this also from other studies, that really people still think that Tourette syndrome is still, you know, only coprolalia, although we know now that from studies that it's only present in like 5% of people. And this is unfortunately also partially because this narrative is spread through media. Then, you know, this isn't just an example. Of course, it's not FND, but it's just important, for example, to distinguish Tourette and functional tic-like behaviors and say that, for example, this kind of symptoms are more typical. Of course, they can occur in Tourette, but they're more typical for FND, more typical for functional tic-like behaviors, because the treatment is also different, totally different. And also because, again, we want to just, show the correct image of the disease so that, you know, again, these misconceptions that sometimes are harmful for our patients are not spread. So I think that, you know, we are, as people who are clinicians, first, during our psychoeducation, we should mention this, that, you know, about this aspect of media. Like Anya said, if we see that it can have an important maintaining factor for a patient and the family, we should do our best to inform that, you know, maybe some strategies could be helpful to use it in less harmful way. And then as the representatives of different societies, and we try to do this with European Society for the Study of Tourette Syndrome, and now with this podcast, I hope, within EAN, that we should, you know, try to correct if there is a misinformation. And there was, for example, a misinformation related to one program that was called Balen Out Loud. I can mention this here. That was shown as a Tourette syndrome, but it's not a Tourette syndrome. It's functional tic-like behaviors. And I think it's important for societies to show and say this is not a real representation and correct this. And it's our ethical obligation for our patients. And like I said, this is important because then it has repercussions for the diagnosis.
Yes, thank you so much. After we have touched so many different aspects related to social media and FND, I would like to ask you both for a short key message to your colleagues regarding this topic. Pep, Anna, you can start.
Thank you. Let me close with some key messages. First, something for clinicians. I would encourage to ask the patients about media exposure because it's clinically relevant and it impacts clinical work. Secondly, I would encourage to show the signs and explain clearly and provide resources. It's important to remember that FND is a positive diagnosis, rule in diagnosis. We should also keep in mind to minimize its organic harm and that communication is a part of treatment. So most importantly, information opens the door, but therapy drives the change. And for the public, I would like to encourage you not to diagnose yourself based on a video and tell that FND is real and treatable, but requires proper assessment. And media can support recovery, but it cannot replace care.
Thank you so much. Natalia, anything you would like to add?
No, I think this was a very nice summary, but if I can just, echo these words that I think that social media, you know, they just inherit part of our world. We cannot ignore it. Also in the medicine, we have to sort of accept it and with its positive and negative signs and be aware of it. And like Anya said, ask patients about it, especially within the context of FND. And if it's used in the positive ways, of course, we should encourage this. But if it is in this maintaining factor, we should be able to recognize it, but not be judgmental, be supportive of the patients. And finally, yes, we are the societies. I think I would encourage all of you to join us within our forces to fight misconceptions. And for example, like we did, I can disclose this, write an editorial if you see, or to inform people about it. Of course, in the nice politically correctly way, but I think it's important to discuss this also within the academic context. Yes, thank you.
Yes, thank you so much for this very, very interesting discussion. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.